Hello and welcome to the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. My name is Andrew Dalbo. I'll be here with Josh and Henry discussing all the good and bad about Arsenal Football Club. Let's get started.
Hello and welcome to episode 12 of the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. We've hit a dozen, Josh. That's quite remarkable. Yeah. I'm surprised we've lasted that long, if I'm honest. So, unfortunately, our schedule hasn't been as routine as we would have liked in the past few weeks. Obviously, Christmas and families and friends can get in the way of that sometimes. But not to worry, we are here on Thursday afternoon, and from Monday, next Monday, we'll be back to our normal schedule, hopefully. And hopefully, Henry will also be joining us soon, at least. We will give you news when we hear about that in the future. Today's podcast, we are going to review the FA Cup third round loss to Nottingham Forest. It was as bad as that noise indicates. We will also briefly have a look at the 2-2 draw with Chelsea from last Wednesday in the league, especially where that leaves Arsenal in the Premier League table. It's not that pretty a sight, I am afraid. And then we will have a look at last night's 0-0 draw again with Chelsea, the second of three games against Chelsea, which was probably a more encouraging game for Arsenal given their recent struggles. But firstly, Josh, let's look at that FA Cup. What happened?
That's the question. I mean, it was just... I mean, it was... Everything was wrong. I feel like there wasn't a single thing that went right. We got, you know, I guess the two goals are something to look at, but it's not like even those were well crafted. It was just the defense. I mean, first of all, I don't even know what formation they went with, because they told us it was a regular, the 3-4-3 kind of thing, and then it became clear early on that's not what it was, because Reece Nelson was kind of everywhere, and then it kind of turned into the 4-2-3-1. But whatever the case, we couldn't defend to save our lives. And I get why Arsene Wenger would go with Mertesacker and Holding, because it worked so well against Chelsea in the FA Cup final, but maybe Mertesacker is just completely spent, because he looked terrible. And thank God he had that goal, because it would have been like career ending, which I guess isn't that bad, since he's going to retire in a few months anyway. But it wasn't a pretty sight. And
no, it wasn't.
I don't know what else you can blame other than, well, I mean, I guess it's a laundry list of what you can blame, but the defense, Arsene Wenger for not having any fallback option. I mean, I guess his emergency option was Eddie Nketiah. I think the world of Nketiah, but that's not that's not an emergency option.
18-year-old kid, here you go.
Yeah, and you know, the midfield, Joe Willock and Mohamed Elneny are pretty much the same player right now. The difference is that Willock has a lot more to look forward to, whereas Elneny has been doing the same thing for 3 years. There's no creativity there. There's not really any defensive flair there. It's just all passive, calm control. When you're facing a team... I mean, Nottingham Forest, people have been downplaying them. They're 14th in the championship, whatever. But they really wanted it. And I feel like Arsenal came out here thinking, all right, let's not screw up. And that's not how it works. And they should know that by now.
Yeah, it was pretty disappointing, to say the least. The performance, as much as the result, was probably the most disappointing aspect of it. Forest deserved to win.
Absolutely.
And actually, they were unlucky to only win 4-2. I know two goals were penalties, right?
Yeah.
And the second of them was this controversial double touch and what have you. But I don't really think that had a massive impact on the result, really. Forest were just a better team. I mean, Ben Brereton, this 18-year-old kid, I've not heard of him before, but he was awesome.
Yeah.
He was incredible. He was the best player on the pitch by miles, and this is an Arsenal team that are competing in theory for the top of the Premier League. The most disappointing thing for me from Wenger's personnel selection was the bench. I didn't mind him resting many players, especially given the packed festive schedule that that he has had to navigate in recent days and weeks. But to not have an alternative option on the bench, it doesn't even have to be an Ozil, a Sanchez or an Alexis. A Jack Wilshere, even a Granit Xhaka, even a Hector Bellerin or someone like that. There was no experience there other than Callum Chambers, who's a centre-half. I don't really know what he was doing. And in the past, in previous FA Cup ties in the early rounds, he's played weakened teams, but then he's had players on the bench that can change the game. I remember, I think it was against West Ham, it was about 4 or 5 years ago, and he had Abu Diaby and Aaron Ramsey on the bench, and Arsenal were 1-0 down with about 15, 20 minutes to go. He brought them both on and they won 2-1. And I think Ramsey scored one of the goals. I could be wrong on that one. But the point still stands that Wenger used to have these players on the bench that he would be able to turn to if things didn't go quite to plan. And in this case, things most definitely did not go to plan. And he had nobody to turn to, really.
Well, I think part of the problem was the injuries. And that shouldn't be an excuse for a team of this level. But I think what I'm getting at there is that I wonder if the FA Cup was a priority for him. If he's not, I mean, the injuries are a problem, but the people that are healthy, he's not putting out there. He's saving them for other competitions. So, you know, there's all these jokes out there that Arsene Wenger is clearly prioritizing the Carabao Cup and the Europa League because he's won the FA Cup too much. And I wonder if that's actually kind of serious, that maybe he didn't want to put his more important players out there to put them at risk because he was more concerned with these other competitions that he hasn't won before. Not that that's an excuse, because every competition should be serious whenever you're in Arsenal shoes and you can't win the Premier League, but I guess in trying to find some sort of sense in it, that's what I've settled on, is he just didn't care about the FA Cup.
Yeah, and maybe it's not the reason that he thought, oh, I've not won the Carabao Cup or Europa League competition or Champions League competition, so I'm going to prioritise those two. Maybe it was just, I want to guarantee a trophy for myself this year, mm-hmm. and I'm in the semi-finals of the Carabao Cup. Why not throw my resources at a competition where if I win three games, I win the trophy? In the FA Cup, I've got to go and win, what was it, 6, 7, 8 games, however many it is.
Yeah.
And you could be drawn against some big-time teams, and all right, Arsenal's still got to go and beat Chelsea, but as they showed last night, and we will get onto that, game later in the podcast, it was clear that Wenger thought that the Carabao Cup was a better chance of winning than the FA Cup, and I think at the moment he feels under pressure to be able to lift a trophy probably every year, at least, if not every year, then every other year, maybe three every 2 years, something like that.
Yeah.
And the Carabao Cup did offer him a more direct route to one of those trophies, even if it is the lesser of the four trophies that could be won.
Yeah, and with these injuries, the I mean, perhaps it is a mindset also of the less games we have to play, the better. Because, I mean, when you look at these match previews and you see the list of Arsenal players that are out, I didn't keep lists of how it used to be in years past. I remember always being upset at how many people were out. I don't remember there ever being this many people out. I think last time I checked, it was like 6 guys that would normally be starting were out, and then Giroud was also out. That's really depleting, no matter who you are. I don't think City could overcome that with how deep they are.
And it's not just the youth players as well, is it? It is. You're looking at players that are 29 through 32. They're the experienced, established and trained members of the squad. Sorry, go on, I interrupted you.
No, I'm glad you did, because I was kind of walking down this path of not knowing what I was going to say next, so you popped in there at a great time.
Right, okay. Well, let me ask this in a slightly different way then. Are you glad that Wenger prioritised the Carabao Cup, and will you be glad if he proceeds to prioritise the Europa League during the latter months of the season?
The more I think about it, the more I want to say yeah. I mean, I'd never want to see Arsenal get beat like that, because it was embarrassing. It was horrible. But if that was the logic behind it, then I'm okay with it, because we are in a bit of a pickle with the injuries that we have and with the amount of competitions we're expected to compete in. And you know, what you said makes a lot of sense about how many more games they would have had to play in order to truly compete in the FA Cup, whereas they're already in the semis in the Carabao, and they're already progressing in the Europa. So, yeah, I'm happy that he's prioritizing, because I think that's sensible, whereas Wenger often gets criticized for not being sensible, for not being realistic, and always thinking that we can win. So, I think I am happy with where it's ended up from there.
Yeah, and also Arsenal got quite a nice draw in the Carabao Cup as well against Östersund.
Yeah.
Who I, again, know very little about, but in theory it's not one of the big boys who could have caused them some quite difficult problems. Really, it's a tie that Arsenal should be looking to win and progress to the next round. Let's reflect on the 2-2 draw from a bit over a week ago. It leaves Arsenal in a little bit of a tricky situation in regards to the Premier League. They currently sit in sixth. They're 2 points behind Spurs, who are in fifth, and they're 5 points off the top four, that being Liverpool. They're 7 points behind Chelsea, and they're 8 points behind United. Do you think they can still catch United and Chelsea, first of all?
I don't think that should be the objective. I think fourth place should be the objective. Can they catch them? Of course they can. Arsenal can do anything, but they won't. It's just what they do. I mean, they show you what they can do, and then they remind you that they're not going to do that all the time. But I mean, I like to believe that we can catch Chelsea. Problem is, we don't play Chelsea anymore. It sucks because we played them so well over the past. I mean, over the past season, and then back to last season too, we played them pretty well, I believe, and it's a shame that we can't directly influence us catching Chelsea anymore. But I think we can catch Tottenham, we can catch Liverpool, definitely. So I'm not a
Coutinho-less Liverpool as well.
Yes, but a Virgil van Dijk Liverpool.
No, that's true.
But no, I think that we can definitely catch them. I don't think that either one of them has shown any more consistency than what we have, and we're definitely within striking distance, so we can still weasel our way in there.
Arsenal are excellent at weaseling their way into the top
great.
Four.
They're great weasels.
If history is anything to go by on that one. They are, yeah. Wenger and his weasels, he is fantastic at it. Also, Liverpool play Manchester City on Sunday, which obviously is a game that they are probably expected to lose, and if they do lose and Arsenal win in a game that they are expected to win, they'll go to 2 points behind them. Assuming Spurs win, they'll be 2 points behind the top four and 2 points behind both of those teams. So suddenly the gap closes quite a lot if that does indeed take place, which I think is quite likely.
Yeah.
So that is encouraging for Arsenal. Let's have a look at a couple of players who have played well over the last week to 2 weeks since we've last had a podcast. The first guy you mentioned was Jack Wilshere, so I give you the floor on the now crocked midfield.
Yeah, and hopefully he's back soon. Didn't look like that serious of an injury, but I don't want to speculate on
no.
that. Wenger
said it was just an ankle sprain, so
yeah.
In theory. Unfortunately, we've been here before with Wilshere, so.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. But in terms of what he's done lately, I mean, we've been waiting for that performance where he really steps up, and I think he did it against Chelsea. That goal was phenomenal. I could watch that all day. It was just gorgeous. And you know, the more we talk about how he's been consistent and how he's fit in, but that isn't enough, the more I kind of appreciate how in an inconsistent team where so few people are consistent, seeing somebody like Wilshere consistent is wonderful, because you know what he can reach if he goes above and beyond. And I think the one, especially in the game last night, which we will talk on more later, the one thing that he's really showing, he looks so quick. Everything he does looks quick. And as we have talked about for ad nauseum about Arsenal, they rarely look quick. On the counterattack, they look slow. Defending, they look slow. But with Wilshere, he looks quick. Whenever he starts an attack, he has that quick burst of acceleration. His passing is quick. It's sharp. And it feels like he's personally trying to inject a bit of urgency into this team. And hopefully that carries on, even with him hurt for however long that is. And then, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens when he does return.
Yeah, I think the point on consistency is very interesting because Wiltshire himself is a notoriously inconsistent player.
Yeah.
He really has his ebbs and flows, and he will have games where he just looks really outstanding as a kind of masterful midfielder where he just bursts past players and carves open defences. And then he'll have other games where the things that he tries, the flicks and the tricks, they just don't come off and he looks lost. But these last few weeks, that's been far from what has actually been true, is that Wiltshire has been very consistent.
Yeah,
there have been a number of games where he's not actually been incredible, he's not been spectacular, but he's just been solid, he's just been good. Which in this Arsenal team that is so frustrating and so fluctuating, to have an even keel midfielder is actually quite nice for once.
And he's learned this over-the-top pass. I mean, maybe he hasn't learned it, but he's really starting to accentuate that over-the-top pass.
Yeah, he is.
I mean, it worked really well against Crystal Palace. He hit Alexis, and it worked against Chelsea last night when he found Lacazette and that horrible effort that followed. But, I mean, that's exciting because that's what we brought Xhaka in to do. And if Xhaka and Wilshere can both do it effectively, then that opens up a whole new avenue for an attack that really needs new avenues.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. Another player who has impressed me especially and many others is Maitland Niles. He's been playing at left back or left wing back, depending on whether Wenger plays a back three or a back four, which is not his natural position, as Wenger himself has admitted. But he's played it very well, especially against Eden Hazard a week ago, and then he played against Mohamed Salah about 2 or 3 weeks ago, just before Christmas, and he performed admirably. And then even against Forest at the weekend, I think he was probably the one player who at least played to an average level, to a level that is acceptable, if not brilliant.
Well, Rhys Nelson did too.
What do you think? Yeah, I'll give you Rhys Nelson, and maybe even Willock as well, but that's by the by. What do you think of Maitland-Niles' recent performances as I try to distract from Arsenal's disparity from the weekend?
No, I think I don't know how you could think he's been anything other than great. I think he's got... I think his burst of speed... I want to see him and Bellerin race now, because I think he's quicker than Bellerin. Seeing anytime somebody bursts down or launches a ball over the top on Maitland-Niles' side, I have no concern at all, because I know Maitland-Niles is going to beat them to it. And we see that with, you know, he was beating Victor Moses to nearly every ball on that side, which isn't easy to do. Victor Moses is very fast. And you touched on, I think, the most important thing is this isn't even his regular position. Yet he has such composure for a 20-year-old. It's just, even whenever he had just come up into this position, he had such composure. He never looked frazzled. He never looked worried. And obviously, I mean, he's still going to make his mistakes. He's young, but he doesn't seem like the kind of guy that's going to let those mistakes eat at him. Whereas we have so many guys, like we've had Alex Iwobi and Olivier Giroud, who when it doesn't go right, they just crumble. But Maitland-Niles doesn't seem affected by that. And maybe he's still riding the high of just touching down in the Premier League. But I don't know. It seems like it's here to stay. And I think the key now is getting him into his regular position so he can be even better.
And it is an important point on the position. I think last night against Moses, we saw a couple of times where you could tell he wasn't a traditional left wing back.
Yeah.
Especially defensively, as Moses would skip past him and get a cross in or something like that. But generally speaking, he's been very, very good. I love how comfortable he is on the ball, which is something that I didn't quite realise he had in him. I knew he was a kind of ratty, quick, athletic, covering of the ground defensive player, but I didn't realise how good he was on the ball, how calm and composed he was when, even if he received the ball deep in his own half, under pressure, he still had the presence of mind to take a touch, to take his time and play a pass rather than just boot the ball clear and lose possession, which is something that is really quite rare for a player of his age and his inexperience. Playing out of position, you would think that a player would be more likely to panic and just try not to make a mistake rather than try to do the right thing, which sometimes takes quite a lot of bravery and boldness. Let's end the positive players of the last couple of games, because there weren't really that many, in all honesty. Let's talk about Alex Iwobi. He struggled a lot against Forest, especially. I thought that was his worst performance of his of the last few games that he has been very bad in, most of them. He also is reported to have been partying on the Saturday night before the game. Again, whether that is a genuine influence on his performance or not, I don't know. Whether Wenger needs to punish him or not, again, I don't know. I don't think it is that important. But it does show that perhaps his attitude isn't quite clearly focused on football. There's a little bit of a distraction going on with him that is a little bit frustrating to see, really, because he's an extremely talented player. Do you think that he is deserving of the flack that he's been getting over the last kind of couple of days, couple of weeks?
Yeah, I do. I mean, just because you're young and inexperienced doesn't excuse you from being not just ineffective, but really woeful. He's been kind of a pain to watch, and I don't like feeling that way for any Arsenal player, because obviously we want them all to succeed, and he's just, you know, in regards to the partying thing, I always say that as long as it doesn't affect their play on the field, I really don't care what they do. I remember when Jack Wilshere like spit on a cabbie for supporting Tottenham, and he was in a tiff with his neighbor about his goal, and Wojciech Szczesny was caught smoking. I don't really care. It doesn't affect what they do on the pitch. I think the problem isn't that he was partying. It's when he decided to do it. He's in the middle of probably the worst spell of his professional life, and the night before a competition he knows he's going to start in, he's partying his face off at 3:30 in the morning.
Which, yeah, it's not a good look, if anything else.
Yeah, but in terms of his gameplay, it's so frustrating because you see he's so good at that initial move to start something. But then from there, it's like it's random. He doesn't seem to have any direction. There was one run in particular, and this was last night, where it looked like a great run, but all he did was play three straight passes, all of which got knocked away by a Chelsea player and then ended up right back at his feet. And it looked like a magical run, but when you look at it, he just got incredibly lucky. And maybe he's just had bad luck lately, and that's the kind of thing that he's going to do. That's a joke. He's not really going to do those kinds of things. But I don't know, because you see the quality that's there, and you see what he's capable of doing, and then you see what he ends up doing. And I don't know how you can put it down to anything other than he just has absolutely no confidence right now. But I think another one of the problems is that he doesn't really have a true position yet.
No.
And I think of Oxlade-Chamberlain a lot, about how he had all of this potential, and people always said, but you have to nail him down to his true position or it's never going to work out. And we've seen that before. I mean, Aaron Ramsey didn't become his best until he was in the position that best suited him. And I'm sure the same is happening with Iwobi, where he has all this talent, but when you're playing winger and then as a number 10 and then deeper, it's like you're a utility man. You don't have that home on the pitch where you know your responsibilities, because it's always changing, and that's got to be difficult for him.
Yeah, and the real issue, the clear and obvious issue is his end product, isn't it? That's the one aspect of his game that is noticeably subpar. And I've just got one stat, really. In the Europa League and the Premier League, I'm not going to include the FA Cup and League Cup, just because of quality of competition and different teammates and things like that. But in the Premier League and the Europa League, he's played 886 minutes. He has one goal and two assists. So he has a direct involvement in a goal roughly every 300 minutes, which is just not good enough. You know, that's no. Every three and a bit games. You can't be an attacking midfielder in a good team and be getting a goal or an assist every three, four games. And it's something that Wenger challenged him on in the summer. Specifically, he said Iwobi should be getting 10 goals and 10 assists in this season. He specifically said this is what you as a player of your ability and your position and your influence should be able to produce. And he's just not able to do that at all. And it's really frustrating. It makes me wonder if he'd be better in a deeper position. Because like you said, starting attacks, that initial burst, a little bit like Jack Wilshere, where he picks up the ball with a defender on his back and he has that real quick explosion over short spaces to spin and turn and drive past the defender. Perhaps he'd be better in a slightly deeper position rather than being in and around the edge of the penalty area where he's quite often asked to play the final pass or get a shot off on goal, and his production, his delivery or his shooting is just really not very good at all.
Yeah, which makes me think that maybe, you know, we've always compared him to Ozil, but maybe he could be more of a Cazorla type, because Cazorla wasn't great at defending, but he made that role his own. He was fantastic at it, and, you know, Iwobi has far more size and strength than Cazorla did, so maybe you're onto something there. Maybe that is a decent path to think about. Now it's just a matter of Arsene Wenger seeing it too, which is always a crapshoot.
I'm sure Arsene Wenger did not see it, because he does not see anything. So really, is there anything else you want to touch on over the last couple of weeks before we move on to last night's game? I guess it's really quite a depressing time to be an Arsenal fan, really, isn't it?
I do want to say that specifically against Nottingham Forest, I mentioned Reece Nelson earlier, but I thought he was really, really good in his first attempt at an attacking role. He created four chances, which was more than the rest of the front three combined, and it was half of Arsenal's total chances. He completed six dribbles, which was more than anyone else on the pitch. I mean, it was the kind of thing that you wanted to see there, and I really hope that he gets more opportunities there going forward.
Yeah, me too. He's a great player. He's just got that. I really don't know how to say it. He's just got that. He can make something out of nothing because of his speed, because of his agility. I mean, even the foul that he drew, it was a little bit of a dive, really, personally. But the way that he dragged the defender in and then knocked it through his legs, and then he because he can beat defenders so easily, he just makes things happen that other players don't have the ability to do.
Yeah.
And he's 17.
Yeah, and I'm truly amazed by how easily he can shake off a defender. He doesn't do anything that fancy. It's just he goes one way, the defender goes another, and he makes it look so simple. And I don't think there's anybody on our team right now that makes it look that easy.
Yeah. He's a very, very exciting talent. Very, very looking forward to watching him in the future, and hopefully we get to see him more this season. Again, we'll have to see. I mean, if Alexis Sanchez goes, then Reece Nelson, primed.
There we go.
Primed Premier League starter. You've heard it here first. Right, after the break, we will review last night's game against Chelsea, which was a embattled 0-0 draw. Surprising 0-0 draw. And we will also look forward to the rest of the January transfer window. Yay!
Whoa.
Because everybody loves the January transfer window with Arsenal.
Yeah.
Because it means they're going to spend so much money.
Yep.
So we will see you in just a moment. Hello and welcome back to the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. We are now going to move on to last night's 0-0 draw with Chelsea. It did not earn Arsenal a point like normal. It was the first leg of the Carabao Cup semi-final, which Arsenal will now take back to the Emirates. And I guess really, just as a preliminary question, Arsenal are favourites for this tie. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean that's. I think we should have all been happy going in and getting a draw, and 0-0 draw makes it even better.
Yeah, I don't actually know the away goals rule in the Carabao Cup, do you? Is it the same as the Champions League?
I believe it's the same.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess we'll find out, won't we? Arsenal did run 0-0. It's their second clean sheet at Stamford Bridge this season, which is might be the most remarkable stat of the season.
I'm telling you, they're handling Chelsea.
Yeah, they are. They really are. It's a little odd. What happened to the real Arsenal, Josh? Where have they gone?
What is the real Arsenal is the correct question there, because I don't think anybody knows. I mean, we look at the last 11 games. Well, excluding last night's game, the last 10 games. The first five of those 10 games, they gave up just one goal. They scored nine. Granted, six of those were against BATE Borisov, which, so you could say they scored three, excluding Borisov. Then the second of those five games, they gave up 12 but scored 11. There's no sense there. There's no way to pinpoint. I mean, it seems like the more they score, the more they give up. But
I truly hate this team.
Yeah, don't we all?
I mean, I love them, but I also hate them.
They just don't make any sense.
How? How can you concede 11 goals in five games?
12.
12, sorry, in five games. And after doing so well in the previous five games, how do you do that?
And then rebound to do what happened last night.
Yeah, I mean, just as a microcosm of this, Rob Holding. I mean, has he got a twin brother? Like,
he might. That would be one hell of a twist.
He was terrible against Forest, and I wrote an article on Penny in the Arsenal. You can check out where I defended him by basically saying Arsenal are so bad at defending that you can't pin it on one person, and I still stand by that.
Yeah,
but he still played badly. It wasn't like he played well, and yet against Chelsea, he was brilliant. He was fantastic. Yeah.
That whole defense. I mean, this is the same defense, the exact same one that faced Chelsea last time in the 2-2 draw, which it wasn't the worst defending we've seen, but it was pretty bad. I mean, Alvaro Morata should have had.
Yeah, he had. Did he have three 1-on-1s? He had two 1-on-1s, and I think he could have had a hat trick, couldn't he?
He could have had probably two hat tricks if he really wanted it.
Yeah,
and there was nobody there to stop him. Like it was. Like you said, it wasn't just one guy. It was the whole defense as a unit failing. And that exact same defense as a unit succeeded against essentially the same team last night. And it was a brilliant defensive match. I mean, Mustafi, Holding, and Chambers were all fantastic. And if this is the future of the defense we have to look forward to, I couldn't be happier. But I still don't know if this is what they're really going to be or if it's going to be what we've seen in the past.
Yeah, I think, I mean, just to kind of pour water on it a little bit, Chelsea did create quite a lot of good chances. You look at kind of Fabregas's header at the end of the first half, Christensen had a couple of headers, Ospina spoiled a couple of Moses shots. So, I think on another day, maybe Chelsea would have scored more than they did. But, overall, this was a very good Arsenal defensive performance that they should be praised for, they should be respected for, and it just drives me insane how they can be so good one day and so terrible 3 days previously. It just doesn't seem like the same team.
No, it really doesn't. I mean, even the midfield, which again is probably the most it's the most contentious point that I think of the defense, and they're all contentious areas, but I mean, even the midfield, Granit Xhaka and Jack Wilshere, I think controlled proceedings well, and when they brought El Nini on, even El Nini looked good. He had that moment where Hazard was in the box and he stuck to him. He was literally just right on top of him and didn't let him do anything. He didn't fall for anything and ended up winning the battle. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that you just expect Hazard to spin El Nini and score there, and it didn't happen. It's like everything went right where everything had previously gone wrong.
Yeah, El Nini looked really good. Which, again, is ridiculous because he was terrible against Forest.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean that is just, it's just this team down to a T. I was saying before we start the podcast that the definition of Arsenal was when, after Bellerin scored his wonderful volley and the TV cameras had stopped showing the replays of the goal, it cut to the live game and Alvaro Morata in the last minute of the game was streaking through on Petr Cech completely unattended. I was just like, how has this club been able to do this for so many years? It was a beautiful moment, really. I mean, it was terrible, but it was a beautiful moment of how infuriating and how ridiculous this football club is. Specifically,
yeah.
No, go on.
I was going to say, I mean, Bellerin and Holding, I think, are two to highlight, because both of them have been on the, to not curse here, the naughty list, and they've been against Chelsea last night. It's like, I didn't see much of them, which for Bellerin's more troubling than it is for Holding, but the less you see of a defensive player is usually the better, and they were both so remarkably solid that it just, it defies what you would have expected to happen. It doesn't make any sense, like you said.
Yeah, no, and that is a good point. I think, I mean, you mentioned the future of Arsenal's defence, specifically that's Callum Chambers and Rob Holding, really. I know Mustafi isn't exactly young, but in terms of young players Mustafi isn't exactly old, really, what, 25 or something?
25,
yeah. Yeah, 25. I think, really, the two players that still have room to really develop and grow and really flourish as centre-halves are Callum Chambers and Rob Holding. And against Chelsea, we got to see them at the best of their talent, at least. Now, what, can they be consistent over a number of games? Let's find out. But initially, in a 90-minute game, that was them at their best. And it was excellent to see, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think another point to highlight, one of the prerogatives, it seemed, for Callum Chambers was to not screw around. Like, any time he had the ball in a dangerous situation, he just punted the ball out. And I think there's a certain magic in seeing that when the defense has struggled so heavily with just getting out of danger. And it seemed like that was just his number one goal, was wherever I am, I'm going to make sure that I end the danger as soon as I possibly can. And it worked, mostly.
Yeah, and Chambers is excellent on the ball. And sometimes that leads him into trouble, where he will try something a little bit precarious, where it's quite deep in his own half. And if it doesn't come off, he's really exposing himself and the rest of the team. So it was nice to see him take a little bit more of a agricultural, conservative approach to his play when in possession. While Arsenal were excellent defensively, they weren't quite as sharp offensively. In particular, Alexander Lacazette has now, eight games that he hasn't scored. I know he hasn't played 90 minutes in hardly any of those games because Wenger relentlessly substitutes him. It's almost as if Wenger's got this kind of, he's been given this mission by God to destroy Lacazette's confidence by continually substituting him on the 65th minute.
And then he can build it up again and claim the product as his own.
Yeah, that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to destroy him and then rebuild him just so he can have all the glory, yeah. Well, Lacazette was substituted inevitably. I think it was the 64th minute
65th,
or something like
that. Yeah, 60, right,
was it 65th? Oh, there we go.
Exactly, yep.
Yeah. And really, the key moment of the game for Lacazette was, you mentioned it previously, when Wilshere played a lofted through pass, and the timing of his run and the arc that he made the run with was really lovely, mm-hmm. But the finish was ugly. The finish was bad, and he had time to think about what he was going to do. He probably could have taken a touch if he wanted to. The ball was bouncing, and he just chose to smack it as hard as he can. He leant back, which is cardinal sin for striking a ball hard. Leant back, ball goes high and wide, nowhere near the goal. It was not good. Are you becoming worried about Lacazette's lack of goals, and also the number of finishes that we have seen that have been a little bit wayward, whether that be through his decision-making or through his execution?
Yeah, it's like the perfect storm of things going wrong for him, because, I mean, to his credit, he had Welbeck and Iwobi behind him, which is not exactly the kind of attacking talent that he that is going to make Alexander Lacazette pop. And even on that ball that Wilshere sent him, it was beautiful, but I do think it was a bit off because it kind of sent him wider than I think he wanted to go. That said, with how good he is on the ball, he should have tried to get a better opportunity than what he ended up doing. But, I mean, every time I try to brush it off is I'm not worried because he's not getting the kind of service, because he's not playing with the kind of guys, because he's not being used properly. I think of all the chances like that that he hasn't just missed, but really drastically missed. Like, I think back, I believe it was Southampton where he had a lot of really good chances that just went really, really wrong.
Which one was the, and you know when he tried to chip it? Which one was that?
That was Southampton, I
believe.
Was
that Southampton? Yeah,
that's exactly the one that was on my mind. Was
yeah, that was very not good at all.
And to me, it just looks like a striker that doesn't have confidence. I mean, I hate to see a guy who just arrived and he's always sulking. He's always, and I don't blame him. I'm not saying he's not like Alexis sulking. He's sulking like, why do I suck right now? And it's a bummer to see that because you see how much talent he has. And I still think that the majority of the problem is that he's not getting the service he needs. And I think Wilshere's starting to key in on that and help him out, which of course Wilshere would go and get hurt. But I mean, it's part of the acclimation process, granted, and I don't think we have anything to start hitting the panic button about, but it is concerning that he's been here this long. I almost wrote an article the other day just about how there's no way he can be happy right now, and that really bothers me, that a guy who just got here probably isn't happy, and that does worry me.
Yeah, and his game is all about goals as well. I know he brings a lot more to the table than just scoring goals, and we've seen that this season. His touch is very good. He brings others into play. His movement is excellent. But at the end of it all, he is a goal scorer. That's what he wants to do. He wants to put the ball in the back of the net, and he's not doing that at the moment. And that would make any player who is built in that mould sad, really. It's not surprising to see him with his head drooping. And it is a little worrying, really, that a player who has got undeniable talent, undeniable skill, can be so downhearted and downbeat about his opportunities. He almost looks as if he's expecting not to score now. And that's really worrying. He also can't score away from home.
Yeah.
Which is very bad. And obviously Arsenal play away from home on Sunday against Bournemouth, which we'll get onto in just a moment. I have very little confidence in his ability to score, which, especially if Alexis and Ozil don't play, and you know his main creative hub with Wiltshire out as well, he's just been ripped away from him, and I can't really see how he's going to score a goal, which is only extends the problems further, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, I guess the good news is that Ramsey should be back, and him and Ramsey had a really good rapport building, completely different style than what him and Wilshere were building, but I mean, in a world where we're desperate for optimism, that's the best I can find, is that Ramsey was really starting to bring out the best of Lacazette, so hopefully that can be found again.
Well, if there's anyone who is brilliant at bringing optimism to the table, it is you.
That's what
we
I'm here for.
We can always rely on you to to shine a light on our negativity. We'll end by just discussing the Carabao Cup in general. Obviously, we both agreed that Arsenal are now the favourites to progress through to the final. Whether that actually happens or not is, you know, remains to be seen. We've still got to beat Chelsea at the Emirates next week, which is far from a guaranteed win. But if Ozil's back, if Alexis plays or Alexis's replacement plays, then perhaps Arsenal can get a victory and go to Wembley. Would you now be prioritising the Carabao Cup over other competitions this season?
Yeah, because the only other competition we can really talk about is the Europa League, and I think that we still have the capabilities to compete in two competitions.
Yep.
So yeah, I think if it was between that and the Europa League, I might have to hesitate a bit, but I don't think we have to pick one or the other. I think we can definitely focus on both.
No,
realistically.
I'm not quite sure when the final is, but I know it's in February, and I know the Europa League restarts again in February, so really one will end as the other one begins.
Yeah.
In theory, it's possible to be able to commit to both competitions without having to pick one. Moreover, there's only two games left in the Carabao Cup. It's not like there's another six, seven, eight games to go and you're committing serious resources to the to a competition that doesn't really matter. There isn't that many games to go, so how much fatigue are you going to impress on your players by playing them for two midweek games, or one midweek game and one weekend game at Wembley? It's not really that. It's not really that strenuous a task. In theory, obviously the injury issues that Arsenal have at the moment may dictate otherwise. Speaking of those injury issues, let's move on to the Bournemouth preview. It's this Sunday. It's at Bournemouth. Arsenal won 2-0. Oh no, was it 3-1? Did Arsenal win 3-1 or 2-0? Maybe it was 3-1. I can't remember. Arsenal won the home leg. That's the important thing. The problem was, with the home leg, they had many of their players fit. With the away leg, they have half their team crocked.
They won 3-0.
They won 3-0. So, split the difference. I was close. They have half the squad crocked. Specifically, these are the players that we definitely know will not play on Sunday per Arsene Wenger. So, take that with a grain of salt. Lauren Koscielny, Nacho Monreal, Siad Kolasinac, Jack Wilshere, who picked up an ankle sprain on Wednesday. Wenger didn't seem that concerned when discussing it, so I'm not that worried. But again, we've been here with Wilshere before, haven't we? Olivier Giroud will miss it, and obviously Santi Cazorla misses every game. The two players who are currently injured who may be able to return, like you said, Josh, Aaron Ramsey is one, and Mesut Ozil is the other, who most people expected to play yesterday up until about 6 hours, 12 hours before kickoff. So that was a surprise omission, and it was not a long-term injury. It was only really a niggle to his knee. So in theory, at least one, if not both of them, should be fit enough to return. Let's assume the worst and say neither of them can play. Do you play the same or a very similar team to play against Chelsea and just swap in Elneny for Wilshere against Bournemouth if the fitness tests on Ozil and Ramsey do not come back as Arsenal would like?
I mean, what else can you do? I don't know what other players, what other options we have with the players that we have at our disposal. Unless you want to talk about starting Theo Walcott, which honestly, after seeing Welbeck and after having to suffer through Iwobi, isn't the worst idea in the world. And that shows you the state of where we are right now. I mean, I think a lot of the confidence that I have going into Bournemouth is hinging on Ramsey and Ozil being fit. I think we can very safely say, and I say this, and I'm already doubting if I should say it, that Ozil will play. Because he, from what we understood, he should have played against Chelsea, but it seemed more like a let's not risk it kind of thing. He's got to play against Bournemouth. And if that's the case, that alone makes me confident that we can get what we need to.
Would you be confident if just one of the two played?
Yes. more even, confident with Ozil.
Even if that one is Ramsey and not Ozil.
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on which Ramsey comes back, because as we've talked about many times, he takes a while to get back into his gear. But
the rusty Ramsey is not a good sight.
Yeah, but I don't know the specifics of this, but I don't know how many times he's returned from injury straight into a role such as that he's been playing where it's perfect for him. So that might change things a bit. But, I mean, at the same time, even if it is just Ramsey, we should absolutely expect to win. But the problem is you really shouldn't expect anything from Arsenal except the unexpected.
Yeah, I mean, even irrespective of the expectation, Arsenal need to win. I don't think really they can afford to drop many more points in games that they should be winning. Obviously, they dropped points against, I think it was Palace. Oh, no, they beat Palace, sorry. They dropped points against West Brom, dropped points against Southampton, dropped points against West Ham. these are games that Arsenal traditionally have actually been very good at. They've been very good at steamrolling the bad teams. But in the last couple of months, they have not done that. And they need to be able to do that on Sunday if they want to keep pace with the top four. Because if they lose and somehow Liverpool pick up a point against City and Spurs win, suddenly that gap is looking quite large. And I am beginning to think that maybe the Europa League becomes a better option of qualifying for next season's Champions League. What are the particular tactical aspects, maybe particular matchups or individual battles that you are looking where Arsenal need to win if they are to beat Bournemouth on Sunday?
Well, I mean, I think the one thing I always remark about Bournemouth is they're actually, I mean, not to the same degree, but they're incredibly unpredictable as well. They've had matches where they've been very good, and they've had matches where they've been piss poor. And it's hard to know which one's going to come out. And, of course, being an Arsenal fan, I always assume that it's going to be the best possible Bournemouth that's going to come out to see us.
Yep. Stretch Armstrong in goal.
Absolutely.
In goal. A penalty in the 87th minute.
Which will probably be disputed and proven not to be a penalty, but won't change anything.
Yeah. A stirring centre-half performance.
I think the key is our defense again because, man, it's like no matter how many we score, it doesn't seem to matter because even in those games where we're, you know, that second string of five games where we scored 11 games, we surrendered 12. We have to find a way. And I do hope that we stick with Mustafi. I mean, I don't know what else we have now, but I'm talking long term. Mustafi holding Chambers. I hope that they start to build a foundation to be chosen over the aging out-of-position options of Koscielny and Monreal.
Yep.
Because, I mean, at the very least, it challenges them to be better, and if they can't do it, that's fine. They're getting older. There's no shame in that. And I think that's the key is defending well, because Bournemouth, they do have some good attacking options.
Especially on the break as well.
Yeah, they've got a slew of forwards that they can call upon to cause us problems. And, I mean, you don't need that many strikers to cause us problems lately. So that's what I think it really comes down to. But, I mean, obviously the midfield is a key point. And you got to worry about who's going to be finishing those goals with Lacazette in the state that he is.
Yeah, I think... For me, I would like to see Arsenal go with a back three just because of that pace on the break. You look at Josh King, Jermaine Defoe, Fraser and Ibe on either wing. He can play an amalgamation of those players, really, and it'll be interesting to see what Eddie Howe does. But they will pose a threat. No doubt they will pose a threat when they have space to run into and to exploit. And against Arsenal, especially against the back four, as we saw against Forest, they leave acres of space in the two channels in between the centre half and the fullback that are very, very concerning. I would be hesitant if Wenger, say, played Mustafi and Chambers as a back, well, as a centre half pair, and Maitland-Niles and Bellerin at fullback. I agree. I think Arsenal will probably score one or two. Can they keep a clean sheet at the other end to make sure they get the 3 points? It sounds obvious, but if you don't concede, then you're definitely getting 1 point. So defensively, it is important that Arsenal continue the success that they had on Wednesday and begin to banish the nightmares of the festive period. Let's have a score prediction from you, Josh. What do you think the score will be?
I think it'll be 2-0. I do think that we're going to kind of build off that Chelsea match, but I don't think we have the firepower nor the desire to really rub it into like a 4-5-0 kind of game. But I'd be happy with 2-0.
Yeah, I will. Will I agree? Yeah, I will agree.
Wow.
I will agree. I think it'll be 2-0. I think it'll be a really boring game. I think hardly anything will happen. Arsenal will happen to score two goals. They'll be 2-0 up after about 50-55 minutes, and then it'll just shut down because they have no interest in attacking. Bournemouth know the game's gone, and nothing really happens. That's my prediction. obviously it will happen. Because any prediction that I make always comes to pass. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on that game before we move on to the January transfer window?
No, let's talk transfers.
Right, well, let's have a break before we do so, because I'm going to have to prepare myself for this misery of selling and departures and exits. So we will see you in just a tick, where we will talk about Arsenal's January transfer window. Hello and welcome back to the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. This is part three. We have looked at the recent games, draws against Chelsea and a disappointing loss to Forest. We are now going to look forward to what is obviously my favourite topic of football. The blooming transfer window, where Arsenal see... as an aside, they call the post-draft period in NFL as the period of hope, because every franchise thinks they can win. The transfer window for Arsenal is the exact opposite. The transfer window is the period of pain, because they just see all these players leave. Just all their hopes of winning slowly seep away with every single departure. It's just depressing. The first departure to talk about, and this one perhaps isn't that bad, is Francis Coquelin. It was announced literally about 30 minutes ago. We're recording this on Thursday afternoon, UK time. So, yeah, the Valencia tweet came out 29 minutes ago, as of speaking. So, Coquelin has signed for Valencia, reported fee of £12 million. Some people have mentioned as high as 22. That seems a little bit inflated to me. I'd be surprised if that's true. But still, £12 million doesn't seem like that bad a price for a player who really was never really going to be a key member of Arsenal's squad between now and the end of the year. And in theory, with more additions in the summer, hopefully, his standing in the squad would only depreciate. Are you happy with the sale, assuming that it's for £12 million?
Yeah, I mean, happy's an odd word for it, because I always liked Coquelin. I mean, how can you not? He was so intense in a team that really lacked that. But happy in the sense that I do think that that's a very good price for what we gave up. I think back to the horrific negotiating for the Kieran Gibbs deal, how we actually took less money. And I mean, I guess had you asked me before he was sold what I would expect to get for him, I probably would have said something like 7 or 8 million. So 12 million is good. I mean, I say that kind of droning on because I don't think that money's going to go anywhere. I mean, we sell people all the time, and we never see where that money really goes. But no, I still think it's good business. I mean, you really do start... You got to start clearing out some space, because the players you have aren't good enough. And Coquelin was unfortunately one of those people that just wasn't good enough. I mean, it's kind of almost comedic that we're selling him as Wilshere gets hurt, Ramsey's still questionable. But at the same time, what were we really going to get out of him? And I do think, you know, Arsene Wenger himself said that that Ainsley Maitland-Niles will have an opening now to get into the midfield, which, you know, whether that comes to pass or not, we have to see. But that's promising in and of itself.
Yeah, and that is something that is certainly would be very exciting from an Arsenal point of view, would be to see Maitland-Niles play in his most natural position as a centre midfielder. Certainly, while he's been playing well at left back, there have been moments where you can see he's just not a left back, he's just not used to it. And Coquelin, for all his brilliance in terms of his attitude and his commitment, there are limitations to how effective he can be in that role. I think Maitland-Niles has a far greater potential than Coquelin ever did. Another point, though, on the fee, on the £12 million fee, I think it's quite a good price that Arsenal have got. I'm just going to read out. It's quite a long list, so you'll have to bear with me a little bit. But these are the players that Arsenal have sold in the last 5 years. and all the significant players, so not just the youth players that they've released on a free. These are the players that they've sold in the last 5 years and for the corresponding price. And it's quite a depressing list, I'll be honest. So 2013-2014, they sold Jovinho for $7.2 million, Vito Minone for $2.16 million, Marouane Chamakh for $1 million, and Emmanuel Frimpong for $225,000. I would argue that none of them have been sold for their value. In 2014-2015, they sold Vermaelen for $17.1 million, Yaya Giroud for $2.5 million, Ignacio Miquel for $1.7 million, Thomas Eisfeld for $1.35 million, and then Bentner, Fabianski and Sanya all left on a free. I would suggest that maybe Vermaelen and Miquel were of good value. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's fair.
2015-2016, Podolski was sold for $2.25 million, which is pitiful.
Yeah.
And then Miachi and Diaby left on a free. Again, no value for any of them. The next year, this is last season, Serge Gnabry was $4.5 million. Wellington Silva was $2.7 million. Thomas Rosicki was a free. Again, none of them were sold for their value. And then this last summer, Oxlade-Chamberlain for $34.2 million. Wojciech Szczesny for $10.98 million. Gabriel Pelista for $10 million. And Kieran Gibbs for $6.75 million. And a token Yaya Sanogo for a free. Now, the reason why I read that out is because it's clear that Arsenal just don't sell players for the peak value. You look at Abu Diaby when he was sold on let go on a free when his contract expired in 2016. This is a player who, at his peak, was probably worth £15 to £20 million, and I know that Arsenal wanted to keep him because of the potential that they saw in him, but a club like Chelsea would have sold him and they would have maximised their value on him. Same with somebody like Thomas Rosicki. Same with somebody like Serge Gnabry. Definitely the same with somebody like Bentner, for example. Chelsea would have got £10 million for him in 2011 when he actually looked like an average player. The only big name, big price player who's been sold properly and well for a good price is Chamberlain in the summer. It's a real issue with Arsenal that they just don't know how to sell players very well for a good price. And I think Coquelin for $12 million is getting towards a good price. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, you know, that kind of correlates to an article I put up on Painting the Arsenal the other day about letting our regressing players regress somewhere else. You know, I think part of the problem is Arsene Wenger's assessment of his own players is always going to be higher than other teams because he sees them as more than just commodities. And there's a certain beauty in that, but there's also the fact that he expects far more than he will ever get, and then it gets to the point where he gets so far along that he just has to get rid of them for whatever price he can. And it just seems so much different because, I mean, you think of, like, Patrick Vieira, he was sold at a time where he could have still been effective for Arsenal, but they got a good value for him. And they just don't seem to do that anymore. Like you said, they don't cut players loose at a good time. And that, yeah, roundabout way of saying, yeah, they finally did that with Coquelin. And maybe that's a sign that good things are coming in transfer business. But I'm only time will tell with that. But yeah, it was a good price for him. It was a really good price for him, I think.
Yeah, and there were a variety of reasons for Arsenal's inability to get good prices for those players. Sometimes it was just bad luck in terms of injuries or something. Other times it was, you know, things like letting contracts run down that we've seen with so many players. Sometimes it was just pure lack of skill in negotiation. Yeah. Kieran Gibbs, for example, they rejected a £10 million offer in the same summer that they sold him for nearly half that much. That just doesn't make sense, does it? It's just stupid.
Yeah, I don't get a good word for it.
Yeah, I don't know how a club of such professionalism and such wealth can be so foolish.
Because I don't think the wealth means as much to us as it does to others.
No, I think that's very true. So it will be interesting to see what other Deadwood Arsenal begin to sell. Certainly they've actually got quite a big squad at the moment. And there are a lot of players who, I think if you could get 10 million for Mohamed Elneny, if you could get 15, 20 million for a Theo Walcott or a Danny Welbeck or something, they wouldn't necessarily be that bad to sell and to try and improve with younger, higher potential players. Having said that, there is always the elephant in the room, and at the moment that elephant in the room is becoming quite large, because it looks as though Alexis Sanchez will leave Arsenal in the coming couple of weeks. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I also consider the possibility that, you know, he almost left in the summer, and I think the fact that he didn't leave pissed him off. So it would be kind of funny, in the worst way possible, if he almost left in the winter but didn't, and it just pissed him off even more. But I do think he's on his way out. At least I hope he is, because you just got to get it done with. I mean, we're holding on to this. And Arsene Wenger the other day, it might have been today actually, said, well, I want him to stay. And I get you have to say that. You can't say, oh, I can't wait to get him out the door. But I still think that there's some part of Arsene Wenger that believes he can convince Alexis to stay long term. And I guess
Wenger believes that his loyalty is reciprocated in other people, doesn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he must, because there is no other human being on the face of this planet that believes Alexis will stay long term or wants to stay, because it's clear that he doesn't.
And to be honest, if I'm Alexis Sanchez, I don't want to stay.
No.
And if I'm Mesut Ozil, I don't want to stay. Even if I'm Aaron Ramsey with my contract expiring in 18 months, I don't want to stay at Arsenal. I want to move to another club, a better club, a club that can win me trophies, and a club that I can go and have real success with. Arsenal isn't that team, and they have some real convincing to do of many of their players, not just Alexis, but and Ozil, obviously, but a lot of other players whose contracts will expire in 18 months, in 27 months' time. They've got a lot of arguing to do for their case, really. And I think it's not going to be an easy thing to do, an easy thing to convince their players to stay at the club. And that's extremely concerning. In reference to Sanchez specifically, if he does leave in the January transfer window, as I think most people would expect him to do, do you think Arsenal will replace him?
Oh, man, I really hope so. I think that, you know, they're not going to replace Coughlin. I think that's pretty obvious. Yeah. But I do think that Alexis is the kind of magnitude sale that you would absolutely have to replace him, even for Arsene Wenger. And I think that's one reason why he hasn't left yet, because I do think that Wenger wants to guarantee that he has somebody coming the opposite way in order for that to happen. And there are some options out there that I think are very realistic options to replace him.
And in fairness to Wenger, when asked about it, he said, we will replace both Alexis and Ozil with, quote, top quality players.
Yeah, but we don't know how far in advance he's thinking. I mean,
No, that's true. Of the potential options that have been rumoured and reported, I'll ask you two questions, you can take your time with him. Who do you want to see replace Alexis Sanchez, assuming that there is a replacement, and who do you think will replace Alexis Sanchez, again assuming that there is actually a replacement?
It's such an important distinction to make with Arsenal. Who do you want versus who will they actually get? That said, I think Nabil Fekir is the best option to directly replace Alexis, because he brings nearly identical things to the table. I've written a bunch of stuff on Pain the Arsenal, comparing the two, and how numerically and just watching them, they're very similar players. Even in the fact that they get dispossessed a lot, they both do. So that, you know, we got that too. and I do think that that's a realistic hope, a realistic guy to hope for, Because we've dealt with Lyon before, and they are a frustrating team to negotiate with. But I mean, Fekir has made it clear. Ooh, that rhymed. That he wants to leave, and I believe it was his dad that called Arsenal by name and said it would be Arsenal. That's a hell of a lot of things going in the right direction. That said, I don't think we can get him in January. Lyon are, I believe, still third in the race for the French title. I think getting someone like Malcolm is a believable alternative, and while it's not as glitzy and glamorous as Fekir, I do think that there is a hell of a lot of value to be found in Malcolm, and I think he can be got in January. I think they're saying that Bordeaux are willing to sell, but they want him loaned back, or they prefer to have him loaned back for the rest of the year, which obviously doesn't suit our needs. But I mean, that's all just speculation. But I think he's a fantastic option. He's got some great stats for a team that's, I think, 15th in the league table over in France. So I think that's more realistic for the January window than Fekir. But I mean, again, if we sell Alexis in January, I gotta believe we have somebody coming in January. I don't think it'll be Thomas Lemar, because I guess Monaco are still saying 90 million, which is stupid.
Well, they've seen Coutinho go for however, what, 150 million or whatever.
They're inspired. Yeah, they think they can.
Yeah, thought, Thomas Lemar, he's worth at least 500 million pounds.
I mean, honestly, though, they're saying that Arsenal are willing to pay 60 million for Lemar, which, if you're going to pay 60 million, I'd rather have Fekir, honestly, because I think Fekir is more in line with what Alexis brings. Whereas, I mean, Lamar is struggling this year. I don't put too much credence in that because it's his sophomore year. You know, Lacazette struggled with his second year too. But I just think Fekir is he's the guy to get now. His next step is going to be his big step that puts him on the world-class stage, and I really hope that's at Arsenal.
Yeah, and we've mentioned this before. He also has that prior relationship with Alexander Lacazette as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was a prosperous relationship as well. It wasn't a clunky, unsuccessful one. It was one that created a lot of goals for both players. And that is something to take into account, I think. Fekir is definitely an option that Arsenal should be exploring. But like you said, I don't think he will be available in January. I think they will have to wait until the summer. Malcolm, on the other hand, I think is a player that they probably could be able to get in the next couple of weeks. I'm not convinced how good he is. And this is just my opinion from watching him, and not, I don't mean watching YouTube highlights of him and thinking, oh my word, he can do all these things. Like, I've watched a couple of Bordeaux games and specifically watched Malcolm, and I'm not that convinced. His delivery is excellent, especially off his left foot. His shooting from distance is fantastic. He scored some wonderful goals. But there are moments that really frustrate me. His decision-making isn't great. He misses easy passes that he should be playing early when he gets the ball, and instead chooses to hang on to the ball longer than he needs to. He's not actually that fast. He's very quick in short spaces. He's very explosive. His acceleration is devastating. But his top-end speed isn't quite as blistering as others would have you believe, and I just have a hunch that I'm not quite sure how good he is. I think he might be a player more like of the standard of a kind of Lucas Moura type at PSG rather than a top end Alexis Sanchez type player, that there are other options out there that I believe could be that kind of player, Nabil Fekir being one of them.
But I mean, even if I could jump in here real quick, I mean, you make a good point about his pace, but Alexis isn't that fast, and I don't think Fekir's. I know Fekir's not that fast either. I don't.
That's true.
And he's only 20, which is my big hesitation for if he can actually replace Alexis straight away. Which I think that he's a good kind of trial guy, and then in the summer we can really address it. But anyway, carry on.
No, I think he's clearly got ability. He's clearly got talent, and he is young. And his stats, like you say, for a struggling team in League One are outstanding. I just have this hunch when watching him play, I'm just not quite convinced how good he is or how good he will be in the future. And to spend £40 million, which is what's being reported, on a relatively unproven player who's very young, and I'm not convinced he's that good anyway, it seems a little bit odd. I would rather see Arsenal go and sign somebody like Wilfred Zaha or Riyad Mahrez, personally. They may not be as young as Malcolm, but they have the experience of the Premier League, and actually I think they're better players. there's also a quite intriguing rumour that they are Manchester United are considering offering Henrik Mkhitaryan as a make weight. Is that something that you would rather see ahead of, say, a Malcolm or a Mahrez or a Fekir?
No.
I love
the idea of Mkhitaryan coming to Arsenal whenever he first made that Premier League move, but I mean, I'm sorry, he's really turned into a bit of a failure at Manchester United, and it's still early in his tenure. I mean, you know, Angel Di Maria struggled when he first came to United, and they sold him straight off. We don't know what he could have became, so you could call him a United failure without really knowing what he might have done. But at the same time, I mean, you know, that the whole we send Alexis to United and we get Mkhitaryan in return, to me, it looks like we're giving them one of our most successful players in recent time. We're getting one of their least successful signings in recent time. And maybe I'm looking at that too one-dimensionally, but I don't like that. I mean, we've done this before. We took Welbeck, who was, you know, not one of their more successful players, and they took, I mean, this wasn't correlating, but they took Van Persie, who was one of our more successful players. And I don't like that we have to give up our top tier for their, we don't really want them anymore. I just don't like that.
Yeah, that's, I mean, there is a report that says it's money as well as Mkhitaryan. If it is, say, 15 million, 20 million, would that convince you?
Yeah, I mean, that's more convincing. And, you know, there's no taking away from his talent. I mean, he's clearly a very talented player, and I'm sure it would be wonderful to be able to bring out the best in him and really stick it to Mourinho that he couldn't do that, because that's always fun. Yeah, that's more convincing. I mean, the more I listen to myself berate this idea, the more I think, you know, everybody thought very highly of Mkhitaryan when he was at Dortmund. And
yeah, I mean, he scored in that last season, he scored 11 goals and assisted 15.
Yeah,
in
which
the
is
league.
So crazy. If we get half of that, we'd be happy.
Yeah, and even this year, after he started the year wonderfully. After 414 minutes of Premier League football, he already had a goal and 5 assists. So he clearly has the talent, like you say. But
I think he still has just a goal and 5 assists, if I'm not mistaken.
No, yeah. No, he does. He's not added to, in the Premier League at least, he's not added to those figures at all. And I think he definitely does have the talent, but there are questions over consistency, there are questions over fitness. There have been some reports that Mourinho thinks he's overweight and that his attitude isn't very good. So there are hesitancies, I guess. But if Arsenal could get 15 million and Mkhitaryan, I would be willing to take it personally. Again, these swap deals, they're always rumoured and they almost never actually happen. So how likely it would be, I suspect he's on quite hefty wages as well. So we will have to see, but it's something to keep in mind, and it's a prospect that I would rather see Arsenal sign than somebody like a Malcolm. Personally, I just think Mkhitaryan is a better player, even if he's a little bit different to what Sanchez has brought over the years.
Yeah, he is different than Alexis, and it is intriguing to think of what his creative talent could do next to Ozil. Again, assuming Ozil stays, which is not a guarantee. But I mean, at the same time, that's almost—that's two primary creators. When maybe you don't need that many, and like you said, the wages thing kind of irks me too, because he has to be making heavy wages at United, and unless he's willing to take a cut, which I highly doubt he is, nobody seems to be willing to take a cut these days.
Yeah, the reports are as high as 220 grand a week, which is
we can't pay him that. We shouldn't pay him that. Which is another reason why, again, I'm going to go back to Malcolm, because I'm actually really excited about this kid, and I've watched a few games too, and you know, maybe I'm painfully optimistic, but I like to brush off his shortcomings as, well, he's 20 years old, and
that is definitely something to always have in your mind, that he is very young, and there's a lot of room and time to grow.
And there's not a lot of talent around him at Bordeaux, and you know, I think if United can pay what they paid for Martial, and PSG paid what they did for Mbappe, granted, Malcolm's not at the same tier right now. He is getting exponentially better every single year, and there has to be something in that. And it is a lot of money that we'd be spending on far from a guarantee, but I do think that he would be more of like a, we'll give him 4 months till the end of the season to see if he's an actual solution. And then if he's not, we'll keep him, we'll try to grow, we'll try to build him up, but then we'll really address it in the summer. And I like that option better than taking sloppy seconds from Manchester United again.
Yeah, I mean, it will be very interesting to see what actually happens. Certainly, Wenger will need to do something if Sanchez goes. Whether he actually will do anything is, I mean, like you said, when you said it's important to have that distinction in the question, what we think Wenger needs to do and what he thinks he needs to do are two very different things. And whether one aligns with the other will be intriguing to watch over the coming weeks and in the summer as well. Are there any other questions or topics that you want to discuss regarding the January transfer window?
No, I mean, I'm still tracking Leon Goretzka because I still think he'd be one of the best. Yeah, you laugh, but I'm completely serious. I think he'd be one of the best all-purpose signings we could get. And
no, I agree.
And it's not going so well. I mean, again, from what you can take away from rumors, I guess Schalke are pressing him for a decision because he was supposed to make a decision in January, and we're nearly halfway through, and they haven't gotten anywhere. But I guess Jurgen Klopp is really hot on his trail, and I swear, if Liverpool beat us to another person we've been linked to, it drives me nuts.
With Keita already coming in as well.
Yeah, it's tough because Goretzka and Keita are probably outside of Bayern Munich the two best central midfielders in the German league, and if they end up on the same team, that's going to be tough.
Yeah, that Liverpool team is, if they continue spending money at the rate they are spending money at the moment, they are beginning to look a little bit scary, actually.
Yeah, I mean, you look at what they did already. Both Arsenal and Liverpool had a clear defensive problem, and Liverpool went and bought Virgil van Dijk, and we bought Konstantinos Mavropanos, which I'm sure he's going to be great. He's going to be a world beater.
You never know. He's looked very good in training.
He looked great running along the sidelines with Alexis Sanchez against Chelsea. It really tickled me seeing that.
He'll look great running after Ben Brereton in the FA Cup next year. God, when he can't catch up with him. That is unfortunately the state of Arsenal Football Club at the moment. We are relying on
He's 20.
20-year-old Greek defender.
But we're keeping him. We're keeping him here.
Yeah, we're keeping him. I mean, I do know little to nothing about him, and I assume you're the same.
Yeah.
So, again, everybody really is in the dark on this one. So we'll see what happens. It's a shot to nothing, isn't it? You take it and you hope for the best.
Well, we do know that it was Mislintat that found him, that gets credit for the signing, and we know Mislintat can do some amazing things over at Dortmund, so faith.
Yeah, and that is important, actually. It shows that Wenger isn't solely in charge of everything anymore, anyway. And the hiring of Mislintat was always a long-term thing in terms of we're going to try and iron out the process of the Wenger era to the post-Wenger era. And the fact that he's already having an influence 1 month, 2 months after being hired is nice to see, really.
Well, Malcolm is actually another guy that Mislintat really wanted at Dortmund.
Is he?
Yeah, but he was never able to get him. So that's another reason, which I totally forgot to bring up, I do have a lot of faith in that kid.
Ousmane Dembele 2.0.
Exactly, yeah.
Hopefully. So I think that is it for episode 12 of the Pain in the Arsenal podcast. As said previously, we will be back to normal next Monday. We will review Arsenal's probably disappointing loss to Bournemouth.
No.
Sorry, that was a tad negative. We'll review the Sunday's game against Bournemouth. We'll have a look forward to the second leg in the Carabao Cup semi-final, which is suddenly one of the biggest games of the year now. And we will continue to review and preview the January transfer window, something that I hate, something that Arsene Wenger hates, but something that will always be important, unfortunately, as long as it exists. Thank you very much for listening. Make sure you go and check us out at paininthearsenal.com. You can find us on Twitter as well and on Facebook. If you've got any questions, we'll try and answer them on the podcast. And just feel free to get in contact with us. We always like to hear from our listeners, and we always like to have a bit of contact with our listeners on social media and stuff. So thank you very much for listening, and we will see you next week. Goodbye.